as close as it was, I was very confident we'd win when we started this race. Many people were not.
Don Young ekes out a victory in the Republican primary for Alaska's U.S. House seat. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 18th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, looking for answers to rural Alaska's energy crisis.
If anybody can find the solutions, Alaskans can. I really do believe that here at the top of the world is a lot of talent.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Alaska Community Foundation, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Your local public radio station has airtimes.
Lawyers in the case against Senator Ted Stevens attended what is expected to be their last hearing this morning before the trial starts next week. Jury selection will begin Monday in the federal case. Stevens is charged with 7 counts of lying on his financial disclosure statements about gifts he received. APRN's Libby Casey is covering the case in Washington, D.C. and joins us by phone. Hi, Libby.
Hi, Lori.
Libby, did the judge make any rulings today that will affect the trial?
He made a decision about one thing the defense has been pushing for, the medical records of VECO CEO Bill Allen. Allen has been the government's star witness in corruption cases up in Alaska, and he's expected to be a keystone of the case here. You know, the prosecution alleges that Allen gave Stevens numerous gifts. Well, Allen had a motorcycle accident back in 2001, which left him with speech problems, and the defense wants his medical records related to the accident to see how much of his brain was actually damaged. The judge ruled today that the lawyers should see that information. Now, only the lawyers in the court will see it. Reporters and the public won't have access to that. And Judge Sullivan also said that the attorneys can't introduce his medical records in court without the judge's permission. Otherwise, today there was a lot of discussion about objections both sides have to evidence, but the judge didn't rule on any of those. He said instead he'll have to wait and see during the trial how they come into play.
Are the lawyers trying to establish that Allen's testimony may not be credible because of the brain injury?
Well, that's exactly what's going to happen. And this has played out a couple times already in the Alaska cases, and his evidence has found to be credible. But Allen himself has said that the motorcycle accident left him with some brain damage the size of a quarter. And so it looks like the defense team is going to look through these medical records and look for a way to show that he may not be competent enough to be this star witness.
Libby, you mentioned that there was a fair bit of discussion about evidence. Did that give you a sense of what evidence will be introduced at trial?
It was a really interesting preview of some of the content we'll be seeing over the next few weeks. There was some discussion about wiretaps that the government wants to introduce as evidence. They're not tapes of Stevens himself, but other people talking about him. And they gave an example of a conversation between Bill Allen from VECO and Bob Persons, who's a friend of Stevens. The three men had a business partnership owning a racehorse, and the government says they have Persons on tape saying to Bill Allen that, quote, the senator gets hysterical when he has to spend his own money. And the prosecutor said they're talking about Stevens having to spend money on his house, which VECO allegedly paid to remodel. Now, the defense came back and said, well, that's a third-party discussion and not relevant to this case. That's just discussion about a horse business. And the defense attorney called it triple hearsay. And so we're going to be hearing a lot of this wiretapping come up in the case. The judge said after this back and forth, he'll just have to wait and take it as it comes up at trial and see how relevant it is.
Senator Stevens' lawyers had attempted to get the case thrown out for a variety of reasons, and the judge denied them all. But it sounds like one of their arguments did gain some traction in court this week, Libby.
Well, that's right. You know, the U.S. Constitution protects lawmakers from being prosecuted for what they do in the halls of Congress. That's called the Speech or Debate Clause. And the judge ruled earlier this week that Stevens is not protected when he's doing official business, things like talking to VECO or talking about VECO. So evidence related to that would be allowed. But the judge said today that some of the defense team's concerns do have merit and that some of the evidence that the government wants to introduce may verge on this, you know, touching legislative actions. So they're going to have to tread very carefully. This is something the courts take seriously. You know, the case could be thrown out if they go too far into speech or debate. So every day the prosecution's going to have to turn over their witness list, and if it looks like evidence might have the slightest possibility of being related to the senator's legislative work, then they'll have to turn over the evidence too. And that way the defense can object and the judge can sort it all out before the jury ever sees it.
Okay, Libby, so now what? What happens next?
Jury selection begins on Monday. It will be a very busy weekend for the defense team and the prosecution as they get everything prepared for this fast-tracked case. On Monday morning, about 150 residents of the District of Columbia will show up at the courthouse. They'll receive a questionnaire to fill out. We haven't seen the questions yet. They have not been made public. The judge will release them after the jurors get them. And then things will start. Senator Stevens will be on hand Monday morning. He hasn't appeared in hearings in recent weeks. He hasn't needed to, but he will be around for the actual trial. And once the jury is selected, the trial is expected to start Wednesday, and it sounds like it will get down to business fast. After opening statements, we're expecting one of the early witnesses to be VECO CEO Bill Allen.
All right. Thank you, Libby.
Thanks a lot, Lori.
APRN's Washington, D.C. correspondent Libby Casey will be covering the trial of Senator Ted Stevens. It's official. Congressman Don Young has won the Republican primary for Alaska's lone U.S. House seat. His opponent, Lieutenant Governor Sean Parnell, conceded today. The Division of Elections also certified the primary results today. Yesterday, the Division of Elections released the final numbers after counting absentee and question ballots 3 weeks after Alaskans went to the polls. Young beat Parnell by just 304 votes in a race where nearly 106,000 ballots were cast. Parnell could have asked for a recount at state expense because the race was so tight. He was not available for comment today, but in a written statement he says if he thought something wrong or inappropriate had happened during the election tally, he would have called for a recount. But he says he has a high degree of confidence in the Division of Elections staff and so will not spend public funds on a recount. Young says he's encouraged that Parnell conceded.
I'm pleased that there's no recount. Sean Parnell, my opponent, was a gentleman and conceded. And to me, that's a good stroke of business. Shows there's a little bit of class there, and that makes me very, very excited.
And Young says despite his narrow margin over Parnell, he's counting the victory as a clear win.
Well, I feel good. You know, I figured I won it election night as close as it was. I was very confident we would win when we started this race. Many people were not. And we decided that we were going to run very hard, in which we did.
But the hard running is not over. Young now faces Democrat Ethan Berkowitz in the November general election. Berkowitz says he is also moving ahead with a full campaign schedule.
We're proceeding through to the general election. We're working as hard as we can, and we're going to do everything we can to win. And that means talking about the issues and changing, affecting the kind of change Alaskans need in Washington.
Berkowitz says he didn't design a different campaign strategy based on whether he would be facing Parnell or Young in the general election.
I've run this campaign from the beginning that it was going to be about the vision I had for the state, the values I had, and the places we wanted to go, not about the opponent I was facing. Because if we want to change Washington, we've got to change it based on who we are, not based on who our opponents are.
Young and Berkowitz will face off in four debates. The first is hosted by the AARP on October 6th. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new commercial fishery on the lower Yukon River.
It's kind of a peculiar market. They want the fish with the head on and everything. As they, you know, they smoke these fish whole.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Alaska has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has been sexually abused or injured by priests or anyone working for the Fairbanks Diocese. The deadline is December 2, 2008. Claim forms are available online at dioceseoffairbanks.org or by calling 1-888-570-6269. This message is sponsored by the Catholic Bishop of Northern Alaska.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents is getting its first look at the budget proposed for next year. UA spokeswoman Kate Ripley says regents meeting in Anchorage are reviewing the nearly $1 billion spending plan.
We're looking at $343.5 million requested from the state, which would be just shy of 10% of an increase over what we got in the last fiscal year or the current fiscal year that we're in right now. The total budget is, as it's drafted right now, is $895 million.
Ripley says that encompasses all funding sources, including income from tuition and other fees, as well as $130 million in research grants. She says the number one budget priority is K-12 outreach.
The different bridging programs, career awareness, testing placement, those kinds of things so that we can help our students be more successful once they get here.
Ripley says other statewide budget priorities include funding for enhancements to energy, engineering, climate change, and Indigenous study and research programs. Regents will also look at an additional nearly $500 million in capital projects, but won't take any action on the operational or capital budgets until next month. Ripley says the board is also considering the latest proposed bump in tuition.
A 4% increase for courses in the 100 to 200 level, and then a 7% increase for all the other courses, so 300 and above.
Ripley says the tuition hike, which would go into effect during the fall of 2010, is generally less than those being instituted at comparable lower 48 universities. If approved, it will be the fourth consecutive year UA has increased tuition 7% or less, a shift from 10% hikes over the prior 4 years. Municipal leaders from across rural Alaska met in Girdwood this week for a conference on developing local renewable energy resources. The meeting was sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority and the University of Alaska. It was designed to give communities concrete answers on bringing down the increasingly unaffordable price of energy. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Steve Haginson says he'd never seen a turnout like this one for an Alaska Energy Authority conference. Haginson is executive director of the organization. He says the idea was for community leaders to walk away with practical information.
Number one, we're trying to educate people about the technology that's available, whether it's hydro, geothermal, kinetic hydro, biomass, and they need to understand not just the good ideas, but the downsides of some of these choices also.
Haginson says AEA is working on finalizing a state energy plan that will give communities a way to compare the costs and benefits of all their energy alternatives.
Today, you know, you get an idea, well, should I do biomass or hydro or wind? And nobody knows how relatively how they relate to each other. So we're doing the math to understand and doing an analysis on those different alternatives that they have available to show them the least cost option for fuel supply and delivered to their homes.
The energy plan will be out in December. In the meantime, conference attendees had the chance to hear in depth about different topics, including wind, hydro, energy efficiency, and wood biomass. In that session, Craig City Planner Brian Templin described a newly installed wood-fired boiler that will heat at least two schools and the town pool. The system runs on wood chips from a local sawmill that used to be shipped to the lower 48. Templin said the city began considering the system 4 years ago.
You know, in 2004, 2003, this was a great alternative for us. At the price of diesel today, I can't imagine not doing a project like this.
Craig's new wood boiler is remarkably clean burning. Angela Morgan from ANIAC listened with interest to that part of Templin's presentation. She says several individuals in her village already heat with wood, but on windless days, the exhaust can get pretty bad.
Local people complain about all the smoke that comes out of the stack, and I think maybe they need to use a different source of wood, maybe the pellets or the chips or something. Because I see that they have some programs going where they're using wood and there's hardly any fumes at all. And the ones that people are using in ANIAC, they have a lot of smoke coming out of their stack.
But Morgan says a switch to cheaper fuel can't come too soon in ANIAC. where so many people have struggled to make it in the last year.
I know of some people that went a couple days during the winter without heating, you know, without oil. It's going to be worse this winter because at that time gas price didn't go up. And then now the gas price in Aniak went up two or three times, I think, gas and oil price, and it's going to be even worse.
Jack Hebert is optimistic rural Alaskans will be able to weather the energy crisis. He's president and founder of the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks. He says the key is to turn to new technologies without relying on a single silver bullet.
If anybody can find the solutions, Alaskans can. I really do believe that here at the top of the world is a lot of talent and a lot of innovation, and that our responsibility is to use that talent and our creativity to come up with universal solutions for problems that the whole world is facing.
Many years ago, Hebert lived in a sod igloo in the Brooks Range, so he speaks with experience when he says the solution for rural Alaska will have to be a blend of looking back and forward.
In the 60s, folks in rural Alaska in the treat areas were using wood as a renewable energy source for heat. So how can we use wood in those areas for both heat and power? And how can we design homes that use local materials as much as possible and local labor to provide shelter for the folks that live in those communities?
Hebert points out that Alaska Natives have lived here for thousands of years, thriving in some of the harshest conditions possible. And he says going back to using as many local resources as possible is part of the answer for communities hoping to thrive for thousands of years to come. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Fairbanks North Star Borough is looking for input and funding to improve its public bus system. Borough Transportation Manager David Leone says more people than ever are taking the bus.
We're seeing increased ridership with the high price of fuel. Our buses are not at capacity, but we definitely are seeing about a 16% increase in ridership.
Leone says popular routes include service between North Pole and Fairbanks, as well as around the city to the Johansson retail area and the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where a free ridership program for faculty, staff, and students recently took effect. Fairbanks public transit consists of 8 buses, which cover 200 miles hourly in the city. Leone says one expansion option being considered is adding vans to expand public transit to lower density rural areas where there's increasing demand.
We've heard a lot of requests for services out on Chino Hot Springs Road, out towards Esther, Goldstream Valley, out towards Salcha. What we are trying to gather is, where is that service required? What time of day? Where is it you're trying to get to?
A public meeting was held earlier this week, and Leone encourages people to continue to contact the borough with their input.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the University of Alaska, home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
With its huge expanses of untouched habitat and the full complement of animal species that were present before Europeans arrived, Glacier Bay National Park is one of the nation's healthiest, ecologically speaking. But the park's cultural resources aren't doing as well as its natural resources. Those are some of the conclusions of a 60-page study on Glacier Bay from the National Parks Conservation Association. Jim Stratton of NPCA's Anchorage office says his group has evaluated 60 national parks to date. Only Denali's ecosystems were in better shape. The report says a few species are not thriving in Glacier Bay, including harbor seals and 2 kinds of murrelets. Stratton says recreational fishing may be depleting halibut in parts of the park, especially after the park's summer restrictions on boat traffic expire.
We've been told that starting in September, there really are a lot of halibut fishermen coming into the park. And so that's something that we flagged for them that we think that they need to take a look at.
Glacier Bay is the spiritual homeland of Tlingits from Huna. Stratton says the park has established good relations and programs with Huna, but only 2% of the park's budget goes to its cultural mission. Stratton says the park should document Huna elders' knowledge of Glacier Bay before it is lost.
At it's not that the Park Service doesn't know what it needs to do to improve its management of the cultural resources. It's just that they don't have the funding to do it.
Stratton says plans to build a Klingon longhouse at park headquarters in Bartlett Cove has been languishing for close to a decade. Whitefish may be the lightest, sweetest white meat fish in Alaska waters. Now there's a commercial fishery targeting the fish on the lower Yukon River. As Angela Denning Barnes reports from member station KYUK in Bethel, it's the third year that there's been a market for the small white meat fish.
For years, the nonprofit fish buyer Quipoc Fisheries was looking for a way that lower Yukon fishers could earn some money in the fall after the salmon fishery was over. Quipoc is part of the Federal Community Development Quota Program, created 16 years ago to promote fisheries-related economic development for 9 villages on the lower Yukon River. Quipoc started buying a small amount of whitefish in 2006 when an unexpected market opened up in the lower 48.
Last year, probably 90% of the production went direct into New York City.
Jack Schulteis works for the buyer and helps set up the East Coast deal. He says there was an opening in the New York market when whitefish from the Great Lakes region became restricted. Whitefish from that region had long been filling specialty markets in New York City, and when its consumption was restricted because of lake pollution, Quipoc saw its opportunity.
It's kind of a peculiar market. They want the fish with the head on and everything. As they, you know, they smoke these fish whole. And it's been a traditional food to some, you know, ethnic groups in New York City.
There are several types of whitefish on the lower Yukon River, ranging in size from less than a pound up to 4 pounds. The commercial fishery targets the smallest of the whitefish, ciscos, limiting fishers to smaller net mesh size. All whitefish are eaten for subsistence, but there is a bigger harvest for the larger-sized broads, humpbacks, and sheafish, which are stored for winter food. Schulteis says they are very aware of this subsistence need.
You know, we talked to all the villages involved in this on the lower river before even going down this road, because it is a really sensitive area, you know, with subsistence requirements and needs. So this wasn't something that, you know, we looked up and said, well, we can make a bunch of dough on this. Let's go try it. We talked to the villages first and seen how they felt about this.
Prices and capacity will be the same as last year's fishery at $1 a pound up to 10,000 pounds. Last year, 23 fishers participated. Quipoc would like to expand the fishery to run through part of the winter, as a lot of the ciscos are caught in nets under the ice. Schulteis believes there is enough of a market for 100,000 pounds of whitefish from the lower Yukon.
We would have no problem marketing that and selling that, and, you know, it would create a viable fishery.
Steve Hayes is an area manager for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
You know, I don't foresee this fishery getting any larger in the near future. We just don't have enough information on the population of whitefish to be able to increase it to have a larger fishery.
Hayes says state biologists hope the limited commercial fishery will start to shed some light on the little-known species.
We're going to have staff on site, and we're going to be sampling the fish, collecting age, sex, and length information, and trying to collect some abundance information. Although, because the fishery does happen pretty quick, it's difficult to collect that information as we're not sampling entire whitefish run.
The whitefish fishery will begin September 22nd and run through the 28th, or until the capacity is met. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge project will undergo a new feasibility review, as well as that at least another round of public hearings. Tuesday night, the Anchorage Assembly voted unanimously to re-examine the bridge's priority status in the 2025 long-range transportation plan. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Proponents say the proposed bridge stretching across Kinnick Arm from Anchorage to the Mat-Su Borough would reduce a traffic glut from the valley to the city, as well as open new land for development. Opponents counter, even if a private partner can be found for construction of the toll bridge, the project still sucks away too much federal transportation funding. Last night, the debate reappeared as an addendum on the Anchorage Assembly agenda. The lines of contention appeared immediately.
I pulled this because I don't believe it has any business in front of this body.
Chris Birch's protest was countered by his assembly colleagues Sheila Selcraig and Mike Gutierrez, who moved and seconded Resolution 198. The resolution, as presented, called for the Anchorage Metropolitan Area Transportation Solutions, or AMATS, to begin the process to remove the Kinnick Arm Crossing from the long-range transportation plan. A subsequent section called for simply deleting the bridge. The AMATS committee is made up of two assembly members, two state officials, and the Anchorage mayor. AMATS sets the city's road construction priorities, which influences how the state will allocate federal transportation dollars for municipal area projects. Assemblymember Jennifer Johnston opposed the resolution. She worried about money already spent.
My concern is our exposure, our liability. There's been $40 million plus that has been spent on the process so far.
Johnston said to reverse the Assembly's previous backing last year in June of the bridge project might mean the federal government would want its money back. Johnston felt the primary change that had occurred since last year's approval was essentially political. The 2008 April municipal election shifted power from conservatives to liberals. Selcraig said it was important to act as soon as possible.
One of the things that's important to let the federal review process understand is that as a community, we have concerns about this bridge and its impact on our long-term priorities in the community. And if we waited until after the record of decision and they said, yes, you should build this, and then came back and said, golly, we really don't want to do it, it becomes a lot more complicated.
The record of decision is the final step in the federal impact statement process. Assembly members asked Jennifer Witt, planning chief for the state's Department of Transportation's Central Region, to answer questions. Witt also serves as a technical advisor to AMATS. She said liability was not a foregone conclusion.
A lot has changed since it was originally added to the long-range transportation plan. Significant enough to merit pulling it out. You know, there's some questions out there, but you know, just the simple cost of construction has gone up substantially and has affected our ability as a state to deliver as many capital projects as we had intended.
For the last couple of years, the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority have estimated the bridge's total cost at $600 million. Witt also said a reexamination and new public hearings would not slow down the latest record of decision schedule. This is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, John Ryan in Juneau, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and October, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.